Today's scripture reading is from Luke chapter 19, verses 1 through 5. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through town. A man there named Zacchaeus, a ruler among tax collectors, was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he couldn't because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed up a sycamore tree so he could see Jesus, who was about to pass that way. When Jesus came to that spot, he looked up and said, "Zacchaeus, come down at once. I must stay at your home today." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
Thanks, Gwen, and good morning, friends. If you're a guest with us today, I just want to extend a special greeting to you and welcome you to our church. My name is Chris Abel. I'm our lead pastor here. I've only been here a couple months, but I'm really grateful you're here, and I hope that all of you get something meaningful out of today's service. I also want to take a moment and just acknowledge the veterans in the room. It's Veterans Day weekend, and I feel like, I know sometimes veterans feel like, oh man, I'm the last person who wants attention, and sometimes there's a lot going on in the world, but we're just grateful for your service, and we want to recognize you for a moment. So thank you for being here. You may have seen in our display, we have just an opportunity to take a little toy soldier home if you want to pray for a veteran in your life this week. So I want to start off with this. I love being a pastor. I never thought I would love being a pastor, but I love being a pastor. I love brainstorming sermon ideas. I love dreaming about what a group of Christians could do together. I love absorbing everything about a situation and coming up with strategies and ways forward about what we could do together. I love the Bible and finding nuggets that I never saw before and sharing those with you. I love managing folks and like our staff and helping us find like a direction that we're going to head in together. I love figuring out the communication, the design. There's aspects of being a pastor that's kind of like being a nonprofit director, and those are the things you don't see up here, but I love those parts even. I love how every day is different. There's one part of my role, though, that makes things challenging, and maybe you know where I'm coming from. With people. People are challenging. I don't even have to unpack this for you guys because you already know what I mean by just saying that. That people make things complicated. People can make things challenging. Now, there's usually, I find in a room like this or when I'm in a conversation with people, like we have two different perspectives on people, right? One perspective is that people can be generous, sacrificial, kind, display amazing courage and strength in the face of adversity. People can be the best parts of life. People can be the reason that we want to wake up in the morning. People can be fantastic. But people can also be malicious, passive aggressive, and regular aggressive. People can be manipulative and cruel and self-centered and entitled, and they can make life awful. They can be the worst part of life as well. It's weird to think about, isn't it? And depending on your experience in your life, you probably fall on one side or the other of that. You probably feel generally a general disposition towards human beings. Now, if you grew up in an environment where people really just cared about you, where you didn't have a lot of issues or problems, where you didn't get hurt a ton, where you had really solid human beings in your life, your general idea towards human beings might be that people are generally good and there's a few bad apples. But if you're someone who has gone through trauma, if you've been hurt, if you've been used, if you've been abused, you may very well approach people with more of a distrust. You might start with distrust, and then over time, someone can earn trust. You start somewhere else, and there's a reason that some of us start there, and it's because our brains learn the things that hurt us. Our brains learn the things that hurt us, and our minds are trying to protect us from being hurt again. This is why we develop defenses. This is why we have guards. This is why we put up walls, because we got hurt once and we don't want that to happen to us again. This is what happens as human beings. I've had this happen too. I've actually had this happen with church people. And this is what I mean when I say it's complicated. I remember Every church I've been at, there's usually a couple people who come up, and they're like the most enthusiastic, excited, bought in, really gung-ho. And when I first started in ministry, I was like, those my people. Yeah, I'm excited because you're excited, and I'm getting more excited, and you're getting more excited. And it'd just be like a spiral like that. And then it happened one time that somebody who was really, really, really enthusiastic, I did one thing that they didn't like, one thing. And they turned on me in a flash. Could not believe it. And to this day, some of the most harmful, like hurtful things that have ever been said to me have been said to me by church people who I thought were like, oh, like they've got my back. Like I can trust them. These people are good. They're the most enthusiastic people. And sometimes I'm even surprised that when there's some people that are like pretty reserved, and I'm like, man, I don't know if I'm wooing this person. I don't know if they're bought. I don't know if, and they'll be so consistent, and they'll be showing up, and they will be there for years on end and give of themselves and be sacrificial. And what I've realized is I'm just really bad at reading people. I can never properly and accurately really understand someone from just like a snap judgment. I thought I could. Sometimes it works, and maybe sometimes it works with you too. But actually, when I observe my own snap judgments, a lot of the time, they're wrong. But now these days, here's a question for you guys. When I encounter someone at church who's really enthusiastic and really bought in, what do you think my internal reaction is? What do you think my kind of my feelings about that person are now that it's happened a few times? Yeah. I've got a little bit of a guard. I've got a little bit of like, uh-oh, one of these people. And here's the thing. That's not fair to that person. That's not fair to that person. It's not even rational necessarily. But because a person that had those traits once hurt me, now I associate that with people who have those traits. And you probably do this too. I call it human food poisoning. Human food poisoning. Maybe you've been had food poisoning before. Like you went to that burger place. Everybody loves that burger place. You went and you got sick that one time, and now you can't even look at the sign. You just feel like an immediate reaction. You're like, oh no, I can't do that. That happened to me with Vietnamese food. I ate some Vietnamese street food once, and I got sick for like 3 days, and it took me years before I could really enjoy Vietnamese food. And it's delicious, but like one bad meal will wreck it for you for a while. You actually have to work to undo some of those reactions. Like some of you have probably had some nights where you probably drank a little too much, right? Or when you were in college or something like that. And now you're like, whoa, no, like you see that on the shelf, you're like, no, thank you, right? Like we have this reaction. It happens with food, and also happens with people. Your brain remembers the things that hurt you and tries to avoid them. Your brain, in a fraction of a second, when it comes to a person, takes in a person, the way that they speak, what they wear, what they look like, how they smile or move, and depending on your experiences, your brain lets you know whether or not that person is safe. And often, what happens is we listen to that. Sometimes it can help us, because sometimes we're right with those gut reactions. But sometimes we end up discounting people who are wonderful people in our lives. Your brain doesn't just do this with individuals, though. What happens to us is that we can actually spiral this idea up. It can mutate beyond just like, oh, trying to protect yourself. And it can start to go with larger and larger groups of people. If we leave this unchecked, what starts to happen is we don't just make snap judgments about one person. We start to make snap judgments about entire groups of people. Like entire groups of people that we've never met, entire groups of people we know nothing about, but because of one interaction or one idea or one thought, we start to judge an entire group of people. And this can lead to something called prejudice. Now, prejudice is kind of a heavy word to hear on a Sunday morning, and I feel like there's been a lot of words like that thrown around our society lately. But I mean this in the very literal sense. Here's what prejudice means. Oh, not yet. That's... Spoiler. All right. Prejudice is a preconceived opinion that is not based on reason or actual experience. A preconceived opinion that is not based on actual reason or experience. So this is what we do. This is what you prejudge. That's what this is. It literally means, like you break down the word, it means ahead of or forward of judgment. Or that's where you get the judicial, like this is where the word comes from, right? Prejudging, ahead of time, not actually having the information and making a judgment about a person or a group. Now, I'm going to put some words on the screen. And I want you to watch and listen to your own kind of gut reactions to these labels, to these people. And then hopefully you can observe your own kind of gut reactions, and I think that you might be surprised by them. So let's just like observe the ways that we kind of make judgments about these groups of people. All right, the first one, Broncos fans. Okay, so observe your reaction. We got a few more of these, okay? The next one, millennials. Baby boomers. Baptists. Confederate flag fans. People who try to sell you essential oils. Democrats. Republicans. Baptists. Muslims. Art majors. Feminists. Baptists. There's no bias there. All right. But you probably had a visceral reaction to some of these. Now some of these are your labels, and some of these are my labels, and you probably had either a positive visceral reaction, like, those my people, or you had another reaction that was like, oof, yeah, I don't know about those people. Right? Because this is what we do, is that protective function sometimes goes to a point where we start to protect ourselves from entire groups of people whom we know very little. I had an experience learning about this when I was in seminary. I went to school in Washington, D.C., there was some really cool stuff. And one of the things I love about D.C. is, if you've ever been on vacation there or you've lived there, is they have amazing museums. And one of those amazing museums, or like many of those museums, are called the Smithsonian. And there's one called the Natural History Museum. And I began to volunteer, and I applied to be a volunteer for the Hall of Human Origins. Now, the Hall of Human Origins is a little bit controversial because it's the evolution wing. Now, for me, I'm someone who, as a Christian, I love science, and I love talking about science and religion. It was a focus for me in my studies. And so someday I'd love to do a sermon series or have like a class or something that we could offer and talk about it. But I really was interested in this wing, so I wanted to be a volunteer there. And I thought, oh, it'd be cool for a future pastor to be given like tours in the evolution wing. Like, maybe this would help some people. So they end up doing a training, though, so that you could be a really good tour guide and know what you're talking about when you're going through. And one time in their training, it was like one evening, and they said, all right, tonight we need to talk about something that we wish we didn't have to talk about. We need to talk about what happens when someone comes in here and has a different view from you or doesn't believe in evolution. Now, probably all of us in the room have different perspectives on this. But the Smithsonian said something interesting. They said, listen, we have to talk about this because we've had some of our tour guides, our volunteers, get in fights and arguments with our guests. Because somebody will come in and be like, oh, I don't really believe this stuff. And then that our guide will attack them or fight them in the museum. We're like, do not do this. Do not attack people for believing something different than you. And so they ended up saying, like, here's the deal. We want you to understand this. You are not responsible for changing anybody who comes in here. You are not responsible for proving anything for people who come in here. If someone comes in here with a different belief, this is something we want you to understand. They have a different belief for a reason. They have a different belief because they either have a religious reason, or they grew up with a different perspective, or they have different family members or friends who have kind of helped them be this person. They are who they are for a reason. To them, it makes perfect sense. You aren't, even if you could convince them in a 20-minute experience through the museum of the facts that we think are true. Even if you could do that, you might go home and they might get into arguments with their own family members. You might have a domino effect that you don't even know about in their lives. And so please, here's what we want you to say. When you encounter someone who's like, I don't really believe in this stuff, here's what we want you to say. We want you to say this. Oh, you are welcome to believe whatever you want. We've just taken the time to gather as much data and use science to the best of our ability, and this is the best theory that we have right now. If we end up discovering other data or information that shows that there's a different and better theory, we'll change our theory. But for now, this is the best we've got. And so please take it or leave it, but this is the best that we're portraying here. So that's what the Smithsonian teaches its guides to say to people who disagree with them. And you know what? Never in seminary or in training or never in my life in any other place have I gotten any sort of training or advice or lesson on how to how to have interactions with people who disagree with you. We do not train people to be able to have relationships with people who believe very different things from us. There's no other place in society where I've felt like I have been given that kind of lesson. It shocked me. I was like, oh my gosh, like what a, like I wish I could be that person naturally. And so now I try to be more that person by practicing what the Smithsonian was teaching of all things. What they realized is that when you talk to a person, you don't know what's going on underneath the surface. You don't understand all the different things. We make a snap judgment. There's all sorts of things underneath the surface. There's the upbringing, their educational opportunities. We have no idea what their world has been like, whether or not they had dad or mom in the picture. We don't know when we talk to a person if they've had some trauma. We don't know if they're dealing with mental illness. We don't know about their financial situation or whether they're dealing with heartbreak or depression. We don't know whether or not they're struggling to take care of, like, parent. Parenting is really hard. Maybe that's overflowing somewhere else. Maybe it's some kind of fear they're dealing with. Or some fear of the future, of their own health, or there's all sorts of different things that when we talk to a person, we never realize all the stuff beneath the surface of why they might be believing what they believe and why they are who they are. Our brains skip all of this, and society is more and more becoming this way. And what I've realized as someone who studies the Bible is that the Bible is more and more becoming radical, not because its beliefs are somehow archaic. It's becoming more and more radical because the Bible takes a lot of time and a lot of stories to explain to people that snap judgments are not the way that you need to be looking at people in the world. Over and over and over in the scriptures, the stories are about the people you wouldn't expect, the people outside the lines, the people who are not on your team, who God ends up using and bringing them over. Over and over and over, these are the stories. And over and over and over, this is how Jesus lives his ministry. From the very beginning to the very end, Jesus had a ministry of not prejudging people or making snap decisions, but sitting down with the people no one else would sit down with. And that leads us to our story for today. And so you heard these words already, but let's look at them again. This is from Luke. And it says this, that Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through town. And a man there named Zacchaeus, a ruler among tax collectors, was rich. All right, we're going to unpack this. If you've grown up in church or gone to Sunday school, you already know a little bit about Zacchaeus. You probably are already familiar with the idea of tax collectors. The idea behind tax collectors was, in the Roman Empire at this time, they took over all these different nations. And a lot of Rome's wealth came from taxing the nations that it had conquered. They would invest in conquering an area, and then they would get back their investment by taxing those areas. And Israel was no exception. And so to do this, they didn't just have Roman people who went out and then taxed people and went to the areas. They had people from their own cultures and own nations basically like buy into the Roman idea and the Roman government and then tax people on behalf of Rome. And there was kind of like a symbiotic relationship here. So Rome would then get somebody to do their taxation for them, and then that person would have the strength of the Roman Empire behind them and be able to take a little bit of extra dough for themselves and pocket it. And depending on how unethical or how bad one of these tax collectors could be, they could really, really, really take advantage of people. They could go way beyond the taxes that an average person would take. So tax collectors in the first century Judaism you were like a sellout. The Romans were the bad guys. And so you were selling out your own people to take their finances and monies and give them to the enemy. That was basically how a tax collector was seen. We feel the same way when someone sells out to our country or sells out our church or sells out our group of friends. Like we do not like those people. And this was not just, this was the average tax collector. Zacchaeus here is a chief tax collector. It says here that he's a ruler among tax collectors. This guy was the boss of lots of other tax collectors. He made out like a bandit here. Zacchaeus had a reputation. He was an extremely wealthy guy. So the story continues. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he couldn't because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and he climbed up a sycamore tree so that he could see Jesus, who's about to pass that way. Okay, another story. You know, we sing this kid's song, Zacchaeus, wee little man, where he climbs up the tree. All right, we've heard this song. This is a guy who is he's a wealthy, high caliber individual in his village and in this culture and in this city, right? So this would be, for a guy like that to imagine like the mayor of a city or somebody of high stature who has a reputation, who can get what he wants, who, you know, this is, imagine someone like that climbing a tree so they could see someone. Like, this is a little bit lowbrow. This is a little bit beneath him. You kind of see this, he's putting himself in a little bit of a humiliating position here to climb this tree. It's kind of a weird moment. And so it continues. When Jesus came to that spot, he looked up and said, "Zacchaeus, come down at once. I must stay in your home today." So Zacchaeus came down at once, happy to welcome Jesus. And everyone who saw this grumbled, saying, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." I think this part is really fascinating. Jesus is interested in having a conversation with this guy. Not only a conversation, he's like, "Hey, let me come to your house today." Jesus wants to honor this guy who everyone else thinks is kind of trashy. And not only that, I love this, that everyone who saw him, saw this, grumbled. Everyone. Not just the Jewish folk in this story. Not just the Romans who were in the story. Not the Gentile. Not the, everyone who knew Zacchaeus didn't like Zacchaeus. And occasionally, like, we know people like this, that, like, who, everyone doesn't like this person. Everyone thinks this person is, you know, is a piece of trash. Like, there's people like this who everyone agrees is a terrible person. This is who Zacchaeus is. And people are like, "What is Jesus doing? We thought highly of him, but how dare he go and sit down with Zacchaeus?" Well, Jesus' strategy had some interesting results. This is what it says. And the next part. "Look, Lord, I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anyone, I repay them four times as much." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this household because he too is a son of Abraham. The human one came to seek and save the lost." Zacchaeus has this incredible transformation, like something that he changes that no one saw coming, that this guy would, there's no one in the world would have thought Zacchaeus would change and somehow change who he was in this perspective. And yet, Jesus, his presence, his approach creates this incredible transformation in Zacchaeus' life. What I think is interesting here is Jesus doesn't judge him, doesn't pressure him, doesn't threaten him with hell. He just gets to know him a little bit. He gets to know him. And this leads us to our magic words for today. Tell me about yourself. Tell me about yourself. Pretty simple words. But this approach, Jesus never said these words, but this is how he lived his ministry. Over and over and over, Jesus would talk to and sit down and get to know people that no one else would get to know, that other people had prejudged. It wasn't just tax collectors. It was lepers and people with all sorts of diseases that had been pushed to the edge of society. It was the dead and the dying. It was Roman soldiers. It was the enemy. It was all sorts of different women and men and people who everyone had prejudged. It was drunkards and gluttons. And we even see Jesus talking about in the Bible. He says this in Matthew. He says that this is what people say about him: "The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Here's a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.'" Like, because Jesus is interested in having conversations with people that he's not supposed to have conversations with people who are different than him, he gets a reputation too. And I've noticed this too, that the people that I know are the most black and white, the people that I know that are the most judgmental about labels or people who are not like them, they're also not only they're not just judgmental about those people, they're judgmental about people who even talk to those people. What happens is when we become hard-hearted like this, when we judge, when we put up our defenses, we don't even like when anyone else doesn't react the way we react. We think moderation then, we think grace then becomes cheap, becomes something that's silly, becomes naive. And you've maybe been here before, and I know I have, and I know that sometimes when you extend a hand to someone, there will be people who judge you for doing that. And that's the world we live in. That's not just Jesus. That's the way we live too, is that you and I will receive judgment for kindness and for being willing to see the person in front of us. And there's a reason that this was such a big deal in the first century. And the reason, I'm going to try to make this quick, because sometimes I think some of the stuff in the Bible some of you, I think, really are interested in biblical history, and I think sometimes we tune out a little bit, like this doesn't have anything to do, but I'm going to share something. It doesn't seem like it has anything to do with today, but it does, and here's what I'm going to share. For people in the first century, if you were practicing Judaism, sometimes we think when it comes to the Bible that that the Bible set up for do this, don't do this. It's about good and evil. It's about not sinning and sinning. Like, this is sometimes our 21st century way of reading the Bible, especially when we look at the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. It says there's 613 different laws that that a Jewish person in the first century would follow. And so we often think, oh, those are laws that, like, if you break them, you're sinning. Like, that is what we kind of read the Bible like. But for people in the first century, they didn't see it that way. The metric they used was actually this: unclean and clean. Unclean and clean. The words here can translate as like pure and impure. This is kind of interesting. You could become morally impure. So there were definitely things that were, these are evil, these are bad, do not do these for ethical reasons. But there's a whole bunch of those commandments and those laws in the Bible that are actually about ritual purity. It's about how you live your life so that you approach the temple in a way that you are pure and that you can have a better connection to God. And some of these seem really, really, they have not aged well. They're pretty antiquated. Here's a few of them. If you touch a corpse, you become ritually unclean. If you have a disease of skin or hair, you're ritually unclean. If you have menstruation or sexual fluids, you're unclean for a period of time. What you ate could make you unclean. But here's what's interesting, is those things are not rules. What those things are saying is, we are a people who, when these things happen to us, we do not then go into the temple, and we do that. We kind of this becomes a challenge for us when we with our religious practice. It doesn't age well, and I don't think it looks well. My take on this is that this was their ancient way of creating a sense of reverence. Even with like Moses in the burning bush, God says, take off your shoes, this is holy ground. Well, are my shoes unholy? You know, are they going to keep me from encountering God? No, but there sometimes are actions that we do to try to create a sense of reverence. The best analogy I can make is like with church. There's a handful of you that are wearing like suit coats to church. I tried it on, but it looked a little weird this morning, so I just went with the sweater here. But sometimes we wear suit coats. Now, suit coats, when someone wears a suit coat, I'll tell you what, if you ask anybody in the room or any of our other services, what they would say is, oh, I wear this because I dress up for church because I want to create a sense of respect for God. And so that's why I dress up for church. And some of you might feel this way too. I personally, I like the idea. I like this service because it's a little more casual. And so for a new person coming to church, I don't want you to feel like you have to reach some kind of pinnacle. I want you to feel casual and be able to come into church as you are. But for these other people, what ends up happening is we want to create a sense of reverence and respect. And I think that's what's happening here. So here's what happened, though. Something that started about reverence and respect began to mutate and spiral up and become something else. It's like if suit guys in our church started with like, oh, this is about reverence and respect. And then next week they came in and you went to like, hey, Frank, how's it going? And he was like, it's good, thank you. And like wouldn't shake your hand because you weren't wearing a suit jacket, right? And then the next week they're like, oh, they just ignore you because you're not a suit person. They're like, I don't want to be defiled by your non-suitness, right? And then like a few months later, there's like a church service for just suit wearing people, right? Because that's how they encounter God best. This is where God really shows up, is for people wearing suits. That's kind of the idea. It's something that started with reverence, quickly became a dividing factor that would then push people out. This is basically what happened with the ideas between cleanliness and uncleanliness in the Jewish religion. And so when Jesus starts doing things that were not considered clean, he was breaking commandments. And so he ends up saying to people essentially, okay, let's clarify here. The equivalent of saying, a suit doesn't make you more acceptable to God. God values each of us. And your concerns for pure being pure before God doesn't make you any better before God or make God see you anymore. Now, this is why I mentioned that this doesn't have much to do with day-to-day life, because we do not live in a world where you're clean or unclean. This is culturally not something we deal with, at least in language alone, because we very much still have an unnamed concept of clean and unclean. We very much still live this way as human beings, that my tribe is pure and that other tribe is the impure, that we know the right way and they are impure, and if we interact, that some of their impurity will spread to us. And so we need to, for our own sake, distance ourselves and push them away. That we very much, that this idea, even though we don't have these religious rituals, is still alive and well in the world today. This is why it blows my mind that what Christ taught 2,000 years ago is so radical today, because Jesus taught about how you go and you sit down and you talk to people who are different than you, and you interact with individuals that you're not supposed to interact with. Like you, that were the people that are judged in this world, or the people that your friends would look down on, those are people that you are allowed, invited, and encouraged to sit down and connect with, because those too are people of dignity and respect and children of God. And then this, it's amazing to me that this is the radical thing in 2019, is to have a sermon about you are allowed to sit down and get to know and talk to people who believe very different things than you, and this is actually closer to the Jesus way than the way that a lot of us live. And you know what? Christians have gotten a bad rap because of this. You know, when I would ask the average person on the street what they think of a Christian, what their gut reaction is, if I put Christian on the screen, their gut reaction would be a negative one. Their gut reaction would be one of judgment or closed-mindedness. And you might actually feel this way about Christians. You might. I know a lot of Christians who don't even like calling themselves Christians because they don't want to be associated with other Christians, because for them, the word has a visceral reaction. And what's sad to me is in a world where Christians actually lived out this part of Christ's ministries, what our reputation would be, what our visceral reaction would be in that world, would be that Christians are the people who are the best listeners. We would be hired to be negotiators because we would sit down and understand different people's sides. People would love to have a Christian in their life because they're like, I can just talk to them and they don't judge me. And you know, that doesn't mean that you give up your own values and beliefs. It just means that you allow a person to be a person in front of you, no matter how different they are. Like, that's what the world would think of Christians if we lived this part out. There's one guy that actually has really inspired me through this, and maybe you've heard about this article. There's a story about a man named Daryl Davis. Daryl is an African-American musician, and Daryl has spent decades forming relationships with the most unlikely of people, members of the KKK. Here's actually a photo of him from a news article you can find online. There's Daryl and, you know, and there's a KKK member. I don't even feel comfortable with this on the screen, but Daryl has spent decades building relationships with these guys, and his claim for fame right now is that he's convinced 200 men to give up their robes and their memberships in the KKK. Like, he didn't start with this ambition. He's convinced 200 human beings to give up membership in that organization. And this is a guy who could easily hate those people, easily judge them, easily want nothing to do with them, easily wish for the worst for them. And he says that he started talking to somebody in the bar. This guy came up to him, and he was playing some music, and they got into a conversation, and somehow it led to him saying that, like, he's a KKK member. He pulls out a card in his wallet. Apparently, they're like, card-carrying members. I didn't know this. And the guy has a conversation. Over a few months, he ends up, through building a relationship and a friendship with this guy, he ends up realizing that he actually doesn't want to consider that part of his life, like, who he is. So he walked away from it. And when Daryl was asked about how he's done this with 200 guys, here's what he says. He says this: when two enemies are talking, they're not fighting. It's when the talking ceases that the ground between them becomes fertile for violence. If you spend 5 minutes with your worst enemy, it doesn't have to be about race. It could be about anything. You will find that you both have something in common. As you build upon those commonalities, you're forming a relationship. And as you build about that relationship, you're forming a friendship. And that's what would happen. I love this part. I didn't convert anybody. They saw the light and converted themselves. They saw the light and they converted themselves. Daryl has made such a bigger impact on the world because he's willing to sit down and have conversations and friendships with people he was different than. And Jesus changed the world by sitting down and having conversations and friendships with people that nobody else would sit down and get to know. And if I know anything, friends, is we live in a world where people are starving to be heard and understood, and that you, no matter who you are, what your story is, or your initial reaction to people, you could be that person to someone else. There's someone in your life that could be an enemy, or an antagonist. They also might just be a friend if you let them. And it all starts with just a few magic words. Tell me more about yourself. Would you pray with me? God, thank you for loving us and giving us grace. And God, man, we are sometimes so judgmental, and we don't even realize we're doing it. We live in a world that prejudges people all the time. And so, God, help us to be people who let people be people, who can let that person in our life just be a person and not just a label. God, help us to slow down that flag waving in our head and instead show some grace and love in a world that needs it. In your name we pray. Amen.